Hello, and thank you for joining me for this discussion about tools for solving ethical dilemmas. We know that we have ethical dilemmas on a regular basis. As practice gets more complicated, as the world gets more complicated, our ethical dilemmas go from happening every once in a while to happening several times a day. Much of what we do involves solving ethical dilemmas. What I know is we know we have a dilemma when something doesn't feel right. Our first indication of an ethical dilemma is either a knot in your stomach or a feeling of anxiety about, what do I do now? Something's not right here. In order to get this issue from your gut that's bothering you to your head, you have to go through an intellectual process. I hope I will give you some ways of looking at this intellectual process in a way that will facilitate your decision making. Before we look at a model for solving ethical dilemmas, we need to think a lot about how do we get to that point. First of all, let's look at values. Values really are the roots of the tree that make up ethical practice. We end up in the professions that we're in because our personal values lead us that way. These are the values that we come to learn from early childhood on through our life. So let's look at what values are, personal values. They're preferences. They're a matter of individual or group taste. There's many different personal values in here as there are people listening to this right now. And we must deal with the fact that there is no easy solution to everything because of these differences in our values. Values are religiously, ideologically, politically, culturally, or professionally reinforced. We go into the profession we're in because it reinforces the personal values that we have. The intensity of our values varies and changes over time and in response to experience. Think back on your childhood, if you can think back that far. I'm having trouble doing that. And think about things that were very, very, very important to you as a child. As you grow and change, the importance of those things might change dramatically. Whether or not you have a date for Saturday night may not make a whole lot of difference to you now, but it was the pivotal point upon which the world revolved at a certain point in your life. In a like manner, things that now may be very important to me may not have mattered at all 35 years ago. Experience changes values. Age changes values. Societal circumstances changes values. And how tightly we hold on to these certainly changes values. Tolerance for differences in values among people varies. Some of us can look at things and say, well, they're just different. Other people look at differences and say, they're just wrong. They shouldn't be this way. Everybody knows you're supposed to do it this way. What we mean by that is, I know I'm supposed to do it this way. But other people may have very, very different ways of approaching that. How much tolerance do I have for people that are different from me? That comes from our very early on learning about differences and tolerance and our experiences with people who are different from us. We know that differences, deviations, and dissent can lead to bias and prejudice. And that can lead as far as assault or discrimination against those who differ. They're wrong. We can't let them be that way. We have to change them to believe like we do. That is not going to serve us very well in the profession that we're in. But we do know that racial prejudice, that religious prejudice, any of the isms are often fostered from very young life on. And if those are part of you, are you even going to be able to deal with people that are different from you? We did a very interesting thing in my practice setting a year or so ago. We were sitting around at lunch looking for something to distract us, and we had people list things my mother taught me, or my grandmother, or whoever, but things that I learned at a very early age, such as always wear clean underwear in the event you end up in an emergency room, and then you wouldn't want people to think it wasn't clean. For those of us that worked in hospitals, we knew it didn't make any difference whether it was clean, new, or what. It was going to get cut off. But it was the interesting thing was, regardless of age, race, gender, the list were very, very similar. So evidently mothers for many generations have gone to the same mother's school to teach their children certain values. Take a minute and write down things I've always known I should do. What are my values? And then look at them and see if you surprise yourself. Also, see how these values translate into what made you what you are. Do unto others gets people into helping professions. Think about those values. And if you get really charged up in doing this, write down whether they're personal, religious, political, ideological. What kind of values are these? Once you have a grasp on values, you can begin to look at ethics. Ethics are behaviors that affect human relationship. If you did not interact with other human beings, would you need ethics? If you were marooned on a desert island, would you need a code of ethics to govern your behavior there all alone? You might get into something like, okay, I have an obligation to the environment. I can't cut down this palm tree because I shouldn't. I have an obligation to the environment, to the palm tree. Are there animals on the island? Do I have an obligation to how I deal with them? But if it weren't for those things on the island, would you need an ethic to guide how you behave on the island? If you were there totally alone in just sand and water, would that change your ethical behavior on the island? Certainly we know if you were on an island with another human being, ethics might become very, very important in what happens there. Something would govern your behavior in that human relationship. Ethics deal with the question of what action is right and how things ought to be. The problem people have with this statement is, who determines how things ought to be? Is it a religious person? Is it a government person? Is it an organization that I belong to, that I have to go along with their ethics to belong to that organization? Who determines what actions are right and how things ought to be? Ethics clarify obligations that are owed one person to another. I have an ethical responsibility to my clients. If I'm a parent, I have an ethical responsibility to my children. If I am a partner, I have an ethical responsibility to that other person. What are these obligations that are owed to persons one by another? Professional ethics are codifications of special obligations that arise out of a person's choice to be a professional. We want professional ethics. That defines us as a profession. We have difficulty sometimes if we are supervised by a member of another profession whose ethics don't match ours. We are bound by our own codes, and we want to practice in the way that our profession says we should practice. Professional ethics are intended to help practitioners recognize the morally correct way of practice. Again, some people have trouble with this statement because of what word? Morally. Morally describes a value judgment. They are much more comfortable if you take out the word morally and just say, recognize the correct way of practice. We need a guide that says, all of us who do this are expected to do it in a certain way. This is what professional ethics do for us. Ethical dilemmas occur when a choice must be made between two or more relevant but contradictory ethical directives, or when every alternative results in an undesirable outcome for one or more parties. What about looking at a choice made between two or more relevant but contradictory directives? In some states, you have a duty to warn if you feel someone is suicidal or homicidal. That's a legal obligation. In other states, you don't have that. But what would happen if you really truly felt that somebody was going to harm themselves or someone else, and the law said you couldn't tell anybody? You would have an ethical dilemma. Your ethics would say warn. The law would say don't warn. So you would have to come up with a way to resolve that question. When we look at the alternatives result in an undesirable outcome regardless of what you do, there are those that talk in terms of being caught between a rock and a hard place. It doesn't matter what you do, somebody is going to be unhappy, usually both parties. So what do? You usually look at the lesser of two evils. How are we guided as professionals in making ethical decisions? There are three different ways. Ethical theories and principles is the first way. Codes of ethics are the second. And practice models are the third. We're going to look at each one of these individually. If we look at theories of normative ethics, we usually think in terms of two theories. One is the deontological theory that says certain actions are inherently right or wrong, good or bad, without regard for their consequence. The one that most people bring up as an example of this is thou shalt not kill. There's just no justification for killing another human being, regardless of what it is. You run into small problems there. What if you're a soldier defending your country? Is it then wrong to kill the enemy? If you're caught in a situation where someone has broken into your house and it becomes me or them, what's it going to be? The deontological theory is a little too rigid for most of us that practice with people that are different. We have trouble with absolutes. So we tend to look at the teleological theories of ethics that says the rightness or wrongness of any action is determined by the goodness of its consequences. There are two corollaries under that. The first is egoism that says, when I'm faced with conflicting duties, people should maximize their own good and enhance their self-interest. For those of us that work with other people, this is kind of hard for us, because we often are in the position of having to look at what is the good of the whole. If we look at utilitarianism, then, we say that an act is right if it promotes the maximum good. when in healthcare, for example, you look at the possibility of rationing. Do you give a very costly transplanted organ to the person that you think will use it the best instead of the person that may not be a good host for the organ? Since most of us work in health or mental health, there's a philosophical basis of medical ethics that helps us in determining what we should do. The first is the principle of beneficence, which says we have a duty to assist people in need. That's why we went into what we're doing. Most of us did not go into our profession to get rich and famous. We went into it to help other people for any number of different reasons. The other basis is non-malfeasance. It's a duty to refrain from causing harm. The third is the principle of autonomy, which is the moral right to choose and follow one's own plan of life and action. For social workers, this gets translated in the right to self-determination. This is a very, very difficult basis for us often when we watch a person make bad choices. Many of us have been in the position of, say, observing a person who was doing self-harming behavior, and we wanted to call Adult Protective Services to say this is a disabled or aged person, and they're making all bad choices. The first thing an APS intake worker is going to ask is, do they have the capacity to make decisions? If you say yes, they do, they are going to nicely, or sometimes not nicely, say to you, I'm sorry, they have the right to make bad decisions. It's very, very hard for us to sit and watch people make bad decisions. But if we really believe in autonomy, they do have the right to do that. The fourth basis is what is called proportionality. According to the literature, this is the newer of the ethical bases that says medical treatment is ethically mandated to the extent that it is likely to confer greater benefit than burden on the patient. This is very much tied to quality of life. Are we going to do something that really isn't going to do any good? Some states have been put in the position of ethics committees can say, we are going to discontinue treatment because it's futile treatment. We are no longer going to continue to do this because it's not doing any good. It's wasting time, it's wasting manpower, it's wasting money. Some people have a great deal of difficulty abiding by the fact that they can be told, we are not going to keep somebody alive anymore. What do we do ethically with this? In the states that have these kinds of laws, they have had to come up with alternatives for people being told this. Do you have so many days to seek another practitioner who may be willing to continue treatment? Do you have so many days to move somebody to another facility? But is this treatment causing greater harm than good upon the patient? The other issues that we think about are ethical principle screens that show up in the literature. In the slides, you will see a list of ethical principles done according to one person's desire to have a hierarchy. We look at the principle of protection of life. We look at the principle of equality and inequality, the principle of autonomy and freedom, the principle of least harm, the principle of quality of life, which is very near the bottom of the list, the principle of privacy and confidentiality, and the principle of truthfulness and self-disclosure. Now, this is a very nice list. It covers almost everything we can think of. My problem with this list is it doesn't list things in the order that I, as an ethical practitioner, would list them. So one of the things I want you to do now is take a few minutes and reorder this. A lot of how you reorder this probably depends on where you practice. For someone like me who's practiced in a hospital all my life, I would have to put the principle of quality of life even above the principle of protection of life. For those of you that have worked in other settings, some of these principles may need to be very much reordered. Autonomy and freedom may be your most important one. Equality and inequality may be your most important one. Privacy and confidentiality on this list is next to the bottom. For many of you, this would not work at all. Truthfulness and self-disclosure is the bottom. Some of you don't agree at all with this. So take the time to do this. Working through these kinds of things will help you to be prepared for when that ethical dilemma occurs for you. The other thing that we rely on to make ethical decisions are codes of ethics. It would be nice if codes of ethics told us what to do. When we have an ethical dilemma, one of the things that we really would appreciate would be somebody sitting down and saying, okay, this is what you do. If you're being supervised, you often go directly to your supervisor to say, okay, I don't know what to do. Help me figure out what to do. But better still, just tell me and I'll do it. Codes are not intended as a blueprint that would remove all needs for your use of judgment and ethical reasoning. They're a guide, and those guides are very, very important to us. What are the purposes of codes of ethics? First of all, they identify core values and establish ethical standards for a profession. We want, as professionals, to be recognized as professionals, and one of the things that does that is for us to be able to point to a code that says, I, as a social worker, believe it should be done this way. It also helps socialize practitioners to the profession. I do a lot of clinical supervision for young practitioners. One of the first things we do is go over professional codes of ethics. That helps them understand what their obligations are in the new profession that they have chosen. Ethics provide guidelines for practice dilemmas. If you think, oh, this does not feel right, you can go to a code of ethics and look up confidentiality or boundaries or whatever is bothering you at the time. They protect the professional from outside control. Many of us are no longer supervised by the same discipline that we are. And sometimes there's great differences in the codes of our supervisors and ourselves. We are held to our own code, so we need to know that code well enough that we are not controlled by outside sources. They provide standards for public accountability. It gives the public a way to know how we're supposed to behave as professionals. It articulates standards for performance and protects professionals from litigation. If we do end up in the unfortunate situation of being in trouble, we can hold up our code of ethics and say, according to the code, this is what I did. One of the reasons that most of our licensing laws say to us that we have to put our code of ethics on the wall where people can find it is so that public will be aware of what we are obligated to as the professional they are seeking help from. Many of our state licensing boards tell us that our codes of ethics must be on the wall where we practice. Several years ago, I was presenting this to a group of mostly home health providers, many of whom said to me, oh no, I can't put my code of ethics up on the wall of my office. I don't have an office. My office is my car. My files are locked in the trunk. Everything I do happens from my office. Another person who was in a particularly good mood that morning looked at her and laughed and said, oh, she said, I solved that a long time ago. She said, I have a copy of my code of ethics on the back of the sun visor in the passenger seat. So if I put a client in the car, I can flip that down and they know right away what my code of ethics is. We had to laugh when she did this, But it is still a good idea for people to have access to what you are held accountable for. Codes are developed in several different ways. Professional organizations develop codes of ethics. We know NASW's code of ethics. We know the Clinical Society code of ethics. We know a number of professional organizations that write codes of ethics. That's one of the things that professional organizations are charged with doing. State licensing boards also write codes of ethics. And agencies and institutions are more and more developing their own codes of ethics. Professional organization codes determine whether or not you stay in the organization. You should never join a professional organization without reading the code of ethics to see if it fits for what you believe as a professional. Professional organization codes are often trumped by state licensing codes. If you are practicing in a state that has a licensing code and it is somehow in conflict with the professional organization code, you are required by law to adhere to the licensing board code. This is most apparent in some states as far as your duty to warn. NASW's code is very clear about a duty to warn. Several states have said that you don't have to warn, that you can warn, you may warn, not that you must warn. And if you do warn, who can you warn? Medical personnel, law enforcement. If the licensing board says you can't do it, it doesn't matter what the professional code says. But this may cause you to have an ethical dilemma if you're put in that situation. Agencies and institutions, I said, are more and more developing their own codes. One of the first things you should do in socializing yourself to a new organization is, even before you take a job, ask, do you have a code of ethics? What are you going to require me to do? Do the things you would require me to do conflict in any way with my licensing code or with my professional organization code? If you cannot adhere to the code of ethics of an agency or an institution, it's probably not a good idea for you to take a job there, because you're going to be in constant conflict with the agency. When we look at codes of ethics, we have kind of the Goldilocks problem. What's too much? Which is not enough? Which is just right? Codes cannot be so abstract as to defy interpretation and application. Codes must be general enough to meaningful apply to variety of patient situations and circumstances. We would never want a code of ethics that, for example, gave many, many examples of professional boundaries. We want a code that says a social worker will keep clear and appropriate professional boundaries, not in this situation you will do this, in this situation you will do that. We need to be left to make our own decisions. If we look at codes of ethics, the code's principles are not always of the same order. Some principles in codes of ethics are aspirational. Wouldn't it be nice if all professionals did this or did that? Other principles represent norms, things that you must do to avoid ethical and legal responsibilities. Keeping clear and appropriate professional boundaries is certainly not aspirational. It is a norm. Codes are prescriptive and they have imperative standards in many cases. Sometimes they clearly tell us what to do about recording, about sex with clients. There's no room for guesswork here. They're pretty well lined out. I said a little earlier that ethical challenges in healthcare are multiplying. Ethical challenges throughout practice are multiplying. But let's just look at some of the challenges in healthcare, because if we look at these, they really apply to most situations in which we work. One of the reasons ethical challenges are increasing is because of increased cultural diversity. We can no longer look at one size fits all. We have to look at the cultural implications of what we do. And I often ask supervisees, is this abnormal or is this different from the culture that you are used to? We have to think about these kinds of things. The world is changing much too quickly. The other question that we have is questions related to life-expanding technology. As we look at healthcare, as we look at are we going to have the money to forever to apply on and on and on, we have to think, who can have these services? Under what circumstances can they have these services? If there's only so many organs for transplantation, who gets them? There are all kinds of ethical dilemmas that look at that. How long do we keep somebody alive? With machines, we can do it way past the point that it makes any reasonable sense to do it. What happens if a family member says, I don't care, I want them alive? For us, we may look at the whole notion of quality of life. For the family member, they look at alive or dead. It doesn't matter the quality. What matters is, are they alive or are they dead? I had a patient a number of years ago that was so ill, there was no possibility of his regaining consciousness, ever breathing on his own again. His wife of 67 years sat at his bedside from 6 in the morning when her son dropped her off until 10 at night when her son picked her up. The nurses were beside themselves. The doctors were beside themselves. This man had no quality of life. But the wife insisted that nothing could be done, that everything was to be done to keep him alive. The staff got increasingly angry, feeling she was torturing him. I got called in to see if I could kind of do a truce between the two sides. I spent a lot of time with the staff talking about our values around quality of life versus the wife's values about him being present. She just wanted him there. She did not want him to be dead. So she insisted that everything be done. He finally took matters into his own life, into his own hands, and regardless of everybody's efforts, just ceased to be alive. We have divergent views about quality of life. What makes life have quality? A good death is what we decide is a good death. A respectful death is what the patient and the family decide is a good death. So we may have very different ideas about quality of life, and what constitutes quality for one person may not constitute quality for another. Another challenge we see is the whole issue about professional autonomy and client authority. We were brought up in a world that said, do what the professional tells you to do. That is not so true anymore. We are bombarded with people going home and looking everything up on the internet and questioning us. And for some, people don't like to be questioned. It's, I know what's best. I'm the professional. Well, that doesn't fly so well anymore. So we are going to have more and more challenges with people questioning our behavior, wanting things done in a different way, us having to look at their rights to have it done that way instead of a way that we've known forever is the best way to do it. Now we need to take a look at the orientations that guide our clinical practice. There are three. First is a clinical orientation that says we are doing what we do in the client or the patient's best interest. There is a defensive orientation that says we're doing what we do for the protection of the practice. This is over-treating. This is doing things to protect ourselves that are not necessarily needed. And it often gets us into trouble. We know that healthcare costs are what they are because of years and years of over-testing to make sure we've covered all the bases. There's also an amoralistic orientation to practice. This is the absence of value-based concepts, an emphasis on program evaluation and outcomes and cost-benefits analysis. We are seeing more and more of prove this works. What kind of treatment are you doing? What are the statistics that that treatment works with this population? Is one of these orientations better than the other? Many people say immediately, oh yes, the clinical is much better. It is the ethical one. We should always act in the patient's best interest. Well, that's lovely, except we do have to keep ourselves in business, and sometimes we have to protect our practice, and sometimes we must look at program evaluation to see if the outcomes meet the cost. One of the things that we have struggled with for many years is long-term versus short-term treatment. Long-term treatment, many of us would argue, is the best approach. Only we would all be out of business at that point because the world can no longer afford this in a healthcare system, or a mental health system for that matter. So in reality, we do a little of all three. Sometimes the clinical is at the top of the list. Sometimes defensive is at the top of the list. And sometimes an amoralistic orientation is at the top of the list. One of the hardest things for many clinicians to accept from their program directors is we have to do it this way because this is what is most cost effective. An example of this is doing group versus individual treatment. Yes, we might want to do the individual, but we know that we can serve more people in less time with fewer clinicians if we do group treatment. So often that orientation guides how we do things. Evidence-based treatment is coming more and more to the front. And that is also almost an amoralistic approach because we are looking at what works and prove it works. Don't just tell me this works. There are four topics for the resolution of any ethical problem in clinical medicine. Since many of us still practice on a medical model, we need to look at these to determine how we're doing with an ethical dilemma. The first of these is indications for intervention. What are the symptoms? What are the facts of the case? Really, have we done a good assessment to determine what's going on? Does our diagnosis follow our assessment? And if the assessment's bad, the diagnosis may not be very good. Is there disagreement about the diagnosis or the treatment plans among the members of the team? If there is, we need to resolve these before we go about an intervention. Is the problem fixable? The probability of success. No matter what we do, is this going to turn out the same way? If we do it one way, are our indications for success better? If we do it another way, are they worse? And how can the patient, the family, the client benefit by the treatment? Are we making ourselves feel better by treating them? If they're involuntary, is that different from if they're voluntary clients? Why are we intervening with this person? What's the preference of the client? This is a very interesting approach. I mean, we're going to ask people, do you want us to do this? Coaching comes in here. We are now saying with motivational interviewing, for example, what do you want to do? What are you willing to do? We know that we can't make people do things they don't want to do in spite of our best efforts. Why are they holding on to the behaviors? People behave the way they do in order to get their needs met. Are we going to change a lifetime of negative needs attainment? What do they want to do? We know we can't make somebody quit using substances if they don't want to, unless we lock them in a room where they can't get a hold of them, which is another ethical question in and of itself. What do they want? Do we ask, or do we paternalistically decide what do they want? Are we involved in informed consent? Do people really know the values, the benefits versus the drawbacks of treatment? Have we told them this may work, this may not work? What is the person's capacity to consent to treatment or not to consent to treatment? Do we talk people into things as though they had capacity if we know better? Have there been prior preferences expressed by the patient or client? This is especially true in medicine where there are advanced directives. One of my staff was walking an elderly lady who had a cardiac arrest and fell over at her feet. And my staff person was certified in CPR, did CPR. The woman recovered and sued the staff person. She had an advance directive that the staff person was not aware of, and the staff person, who felt very good about saving a life, suddenly was in a lot of trouble for doing that. What did the client or the patient want? Is the client compliant with treatment? People may say, oh, yes, I want this done. Yes, yes, yes. But then there's no compliance at all. We need to look at, what is this non-compliance about? Is it about resistance? Is it about ignorance? Is it about fear? What is it about? A young supervisee came to my office with, this lady's driving me crazy. She's in the emergency room on a regular basis, and she's okay. And my question was, why is she coming to the emergency room? Well, she has symptoms, the supervisee said. She's coming up with all these symptoms. I said, no, why is she in the emergency room? After somewhat of a struggle, we decided that she was in the emergency room because she was lonesome. And telling her, there's nothing wrong with you, go home, was not keeping her from coming back. We needed to figure out first why she was there, and if it was out of loneliness, what could we do to fix the loneliness to keep her out of the emergency room? Her expressed preference for medical treatment was not her real preference. So we had to look at, why is she here? We had to listen to her. We had to think about what was happening. Do we respect the autonomy of the patient, or are we paternalistic? In the comments about what is a good death versus what is a respectful death, we figure out what's good for people that would make their death good. They're pain-free, they're conscious, they're whatever in our own head. It's very, very subjective, and it's based a lot on how we would feel if that was us. That may not be at all what they want. When do we stop deciding what's good for a person and listen to them tell us what they think is good for them, or listen to the resistance when we are trying to get them to do it our way instead of theirs? What about quality of life? I've spoken several times about the notion of quality of life. What are the prospects of this person's recovery with or without treatment? Are they going to return to normal functioning? Am I going to just make symptoms go away? Or am I going to look for the root cause of the symptoms? If I just make symptoms go away, it will make them feel better for a period of time. I joined a discussion at one point about people that worked with substance abusers. And for those of us who want to fix people and have them stay fixed forever, we were having some difficulty with treating substance abusers who didn't stay fixed forever. And a person that had many, many years experience in this area said, "Wait a minute, you all are looking at this all wrong." She said, "I feel good about treating somebody if he stays clean and sober 6 months longer than he ever has before." She said, "To me, that is success." And given what she does, she's very good at it, and this is a wonderful way to look at it. For her, 6 months of sobriety was normal functioning. It was good. For others, it was, "You're going to waste your time for just 6 months." We have to look at our own belief system. Do we have biases and prejudices when we're evaluating quality of life? Do we look at what is a good quality of life for a mother with six kids that is having difficulty in every area of her life? Do we have to fix it as we would say we wanted fixed? Or do we have to listen to her to tell us what would make her life better? I remember as a very young social worker going out on a home visit to a blind veteran. I was doing placement in the VA. And I had the full resource arsenal of the government. I went into a house on a very cold day in a part of the city that I had probably never been in before in my life, in a government car thinking I was invincible because I had federal license plates. And I arrived at this house where this very elderly male blind veteran was. And I went in and it was cold. It was sparsely furnished. It was not very comfortable for my middle class eyes. And I wanted to fix everything. And he said to me, when I got there, "I want a Braille watch." Well, I wanted to give him a Braille watch and get a place heated better and get weather stripping done and get him more furniture. I was ready to save him forever and ever and ever. And he kept saying no. Everything I offered him, he said no. I got back. I told my field instructor that I had failed miserably. She said, "What did he want?" I told her. She said, "Get it for him." She said, "Then you will not have failed him. You are putting your values onto him." That was a good life lesson to learn early on in life. My notion of quality of life and his were very, very different. Is the person unhappy with where they are? Or are we unhappy with where they are? What if they decide they don't want treatment anymore and we feel like they need treatment? I'll give you an example of this later when someone felt they had miserably failed ethically because they couldn't get somebody to do what they thought they needed to do in the way of treatment. What about plans for comfort and palliative care? This is an ethical issue that we run across all the time. When is enough enough? When does a person have a right to say, "I no longer want to go on with this treatment, whether it be physical health or mental health or substance abuse treatment. I'm done. When do we step back and support their right to say that? They have the right to self-determination. What are the contextual contexts? What are the features of the environment? What are family issues that influence treatment? It might be very clear that someone wants to do something, but they have no backing from their family. What do we do in a situation like this? We are a person and environment group. I do some consultation for licensed professional counselors, and they laugh at me on a regular basis. Because I ask them, what's going on in the environment? What, aside from interpsychic stuff, is going on with your client? What about his family or lack of family? What about his housing or lack of housing? One of them laughed at me recently and said, you know, I'm getting nervous. I think you're turning me into a social worker. I said, well, you know, environment is kind of what we're about as much as we are what's going on inside someone's head. What are provider issues that might influence treatment? Are there biases? Are there prejudices on our part that may enter into this? Is there just plain cultural incompetence as far as knowing what's a person's belief system that would influence what's going on? Are there financial or economic factors that enter into what's happening here? What happens when someone's coming for treatment and the payer or the person say, I can't come anymore, I don't have the money? Or the insurance company says, that's it, that's enough, we're not paying anymore. And you don't feel like they're done. What do you do at that point? You have a real ethical dilemma. Do you continue to see them? Do you see that they're referred somewhere else? Religious and cultural factors enter into what we do. And sometimes we don't pay enough attention to these. Sometimes, and for many years it was true, that we thought one size fit all. We didn't even look at the cultural context. Thank goodness we are doing more and more of that. And it is a must because we cannot impose our cultural values, but we have to learn and listen to be able not to do that. Allocation of resources. We've heard this in the healthcare debate for years. Does everybody have a right to healthcare? Is it something that's guaranteed to them? Or do those that own the goal make the rules? Unfortunately, that has been true in many, many instances. But who gets the resource if there's not enough to go around? What are the legal implications involved in what we do? Do we treat because we're afraid somebody will sue us if we don't? Do we stop treating if we're afraid somebody will sue us? The best way in the world to scare a practitioner to death is for a client to say, I'm going to sue you. We stop, we relook, we rethink because there is a certain amount of protection. If we deny treatment, can we be held legally accountable? Is research or teaching involved? We laughed the other day talking about the case that the agency has had for 25 years. Every clinician in the agency has tried their hand and failed, but the person continues with the agency for any number of reasons. Somebody said, oh, that's the perfect student case. We all know what to do with those. When we have all failed, we give it to a student. That's not terribly ethical, not for the student, because we know we've set them up to fail. Is it research and we keep somebody coming for treatment because they're part of a research protocol? And we think that it's really not doing them very much good, but we don't want them to be lost to the treatment protocol. These are issues we have to think about. Is there any kind of conflict of interest that we are dealing with? There are any number of ways you can look at conflict of interest or institutional conflicts. Does that impact our treatment? If we are pro-life and work in a pro-choice clinic, there is an institutional conflict with our belief system and our ethics. Do we belong there? Should we be there? Or should we be dealing with this in a different way? The most important thing we need to have when we have an ethical dilemma is a way of thinking about it. I said early on that we needed something to get it from our gut where Mr. Yuck is saying, this is not right, this is a problem, to our head where we can think it through intellectually instead of emotionally. people sometimes say they make their best decisions emotionally. The only problem with emotional decisions for professionals is they don't look good in a courtroom where you may have to defend, or in an ethical review board where you have to defend what you have done. I did it because it just seemed to be the right thing is not always helpful. So I would like to spend time looking at the process of ethical decision making. There are a number of models for ethical decision making out there. I happen to like Frederick Rehmer's model. It makes the most sense for me. And what I know from doing a lot of crisis intervention is when I am in an emotionally charged situation, if I can pull up a schema in my head to focus my thinking, I tend to make much better decisions. So let's look at the process of ethical decision making that Rehmer puts forth and see if we can apply it. Think about a case that you have had recently in your setting where you knew there was an ethical problem. Think about what you did to help you get through that process. This is a long model. And what many people say to me is, get over it. You know, I don't have time when something comes up in a practice situation to go through all of this intellectual activity. But as we go through this, if you think about a model, especially a model like this, and you think about a recent problem, I bet you really did most of these steps without even thinking about it. So let's start at the very beginning. First of all, you need to identify ethical issues, including professional values and duties that conflict. A young supervisee of mine came to supervision with a case recently of a woman that was seen in the emergency room as a result of spousal abuse. And there were a lot of cultural factors. The family didn't want her to report to go to a shelter because it would bring shame on the family if people knew that. The young social worker tried every way in the world that she could to convince this woman it was not physically safe or emotionally safe for her to return home. And the woman went anyway. She returned to the situation. The supervisee came saying, I didn't do enough. I failed. And I said to her, what was your conflict? And she said, well, I had a duty to protect. But I said, you had a duty to honor her right to self-determination. That clarified things for her. She still was not happy, but it clarified things for her. She knew what the pull was at that point. She said, I wanted to be very paternalistic. I wasn't listening to her tell me what she wanted to do, because I was convinced that really wasn't what she wanted to do. I said to her, yes, it really was what she wanted to do for any number of reasons. So she was able to look at her ethical dilemma differently. One of the things that we have to do before we solve an ethical dilemma is determine what the problem is. A child placement worker was talking in terms of, does the child go to mom where there's possible sexual abuse, or to dad that lives in a devil worship cult? And those were her alternatives as far as her ethical dilemma of what do I do with this child. I said to her, wait. Are those your only two alternatives? And she said, well, as I see it, it is. She was already on the road to having difficulty because she confined herself so much to either or. That's what often happens when we have an ethical dilemma. We see either this or that. When in reality, the solution to the dilemma often lies in the middle. Her question was not, does the child go to dad or to mom? The question was, what do I do with this child? Which opened up a whole bunch more possibilities than the kid either going to mom or dad. So look at the dilemma. Try to figure out what the conflict is in your own head that's causing this to be difficult. Then you identify the individuals, the groups, the organizations likely to be affected by the decision. In the case of the young child, and where do we put the child? It was the child, both the parents, the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, the legal system, the school system on some level because they knew what was going on, the church because it entered into that a great deal. You can make a very long list of who is impacted by the decision that is made. Again, think about a recent ethical dilemma that you have had and try to jot down who all is involved in the dilemma and in the solution to the dilemma. I imagine that your list will be much longer than you ever imagined it would be. And the more people that are involved, very often the more alternatives you have to how you're going to solve this ethical dilemma. Next thing you need to do is identify all of the viable courses of action and the participants involved in each, along with the potential benefits and risk of each. This is where people look at me and kind of blank out thinking, oh, no, I do not have time to think about all this stuff. But again, I think that we do this in our head without even thinking about it. In the case of the young woman in the emergency room that had been beaten by her husband, what were the courses of action? Certainly, we do a safety plan with her. Certainly, we offer all the resources that we can come up with in the community. We look at family involvement. We look at her beliefs and practices about her marriage and her responsibilities and roles in that marriage. What could she do? Again, the practitioner saw, go home, go to a shelter. Well, could that be go to a friend's house, get a restraining order to keep him out of the house? And what would be the implications for everybody? If she had gotten a restraining order, for example, to keep the abusive husband out of the house, what would be the benefits and risk of that? We don't know. But we need to think about those kinds of things. We can't just think about the benefit to the victim of this. We have to think about what is that other person involved going to do as a result of that. It was very clear that the family did not want any publicity about what was going on because it would bring shame on the family and their culture. What were the potential benefits and risk of not making this public enough for her to go to a shelter? Again, don't look at either or solutions, because either or solutions often steer you in the wrong direction. What are the courses of action? How many different things can we do? Sometimes just sitting down and jotting down possibilities will rattle your brain enough for you to come up with something.
Okay.
After you identify the individuals, groups, and organizations likely to be affected by the decision, you have to look at the courses of action and participants involved in each course of action that you could come up with. Again, this leads you to don't look at just two solutions. Don't look at either or. How many different possibilities are there? This is a good time to brainstorm. Think back on the last ethical dilemma you have had. Think about what you saw as possibilities. Were there just two? Did you come up with a solution that was not at all related to the two that you had thought of initially? Who were the participants involved in each course of action, along with the potential benefits and risk for each of those participants? This takes it out of the realm of the one-to-one and puts it in the realm of the group. In the case of the young woman that came into the emergency room having been beaten, were there just two solutions, or were there more than two? The family was adamant that they did not want her to go to a shelter, that they did not want her to file any charges. Would it have been helpful to say to the family, then what are you going to do to help her? Who here is willing to do something to help her in this situation if you want to keep this a family matter and not involve other people? What would be the risk and benefits for family members if they did step in and become involved? What about friends? Were there any friends she could go stay with for a period of time until another solution was found? What would be the benefits or the risk to the friends if that happened? Where do we go? We tend to think we have to come up with a solution immediately. But that is not always the best thing. You do the next best thing and then amend the treatment plan sometimes. When we come up with the reasons in favor and opposed to each course of action, there are things we need to think about. What about ethical theories and principles and guidelines that are involved in each of those courses of action? In the case of the young child and the worker who was trying to decide whether to send the child back to a possible abusive situation with supervision or whether to send it to the father in the devil worship commune, what ethical theories and principles would guide us in what we do? The notion of family preservation, the notion of dealing with the person in the way that they wanted to be dealt with. Was this child old enough to ask if they had a preference about what was to happen to them? What about confidentiality? What about privacy? What about quality of life? What were the theories and principles involved here? Were we looking at a deontological perspective that said, you do this always? Were we looking at something else that said, what is in the best interest of all involved? What are our codes of ethics and legal principles say to us about what we're doing? Is there something pretty definite in a code, an organizational code, an institutional code, a licensing code that says, this is the way you handle this? Have we thought about that? Practice theories and principles. Self-determination is an ethical principle. It's also a practice principle. Have we considered these kinds of things for everybody? What about personal values? We are told that we must be value neutral. That's a nice theoretical, aspirational thing to be told. But what do our own values say about this? What if we have very strong values I did this presentation once to another group of professionals, and a person in the back of the room at one point stood up and announced, "You can't let yourself get involved in this at all." And I said to her, "Well, that's nice on an aspirational situation. But if I have very, very strong feelings, I'm going to have to deal with my feelings before I can make a reasonable professional decision. I am going to have to make sure that I am making that decision based on the best interest of the client, not on what I think is right or wrong. What are my religious values? What if I have a religious value that is very much in conflict with what I am dealing with? Cultural values. Everybody should do it this way because we all know in my culture it works this way. What if your culture is very, very different from the client? Ethnic values, political ideologies. I had a very funny interaction with a group of physical therapists at one point about the Medicare regulations say you can have therapy until you reach this plateau and then we won't pay for it anymore, but you know that somebody needs it. And one of them said, "You cut them off. The minute they get to that plateau, that's it. But you really know that they would get a little bit better if they had a little bit more." "Nope," she said, "you cut them off." She said, "It's my political belief that government money should not be used except the way government money should be used." Well, everybody in the room jumped on her. So she was in a terrible position at that point because she had voiced a political belief system that was not compatible with her peers. And the peers felt that this should not guide what she did for her clients, that what should guide what she did for her clients was what she felt in her professional heart and mind was the best thing for the clients. If we have believed something our whole life, but it does not fit for the client, what are we going to do? This is when it's very nice to seek consultation, to help somebody. Very often when people come to me for ethics consults, I say, "Tell me the story." As they start to tell the story, they get this wonderful aha look in their eyes. Everything they have been struggling with is caught somewhere between their gut and their head. When they tell the story, they have to get it to their head to get it out of their mouths. So very often what they say to me is, "I know what to do. All I had to do was say it out loud because then I structured it in my own mind." So sometimes just the telling of the story allows people to sort through conflicts that they have. I really had trouble with a client deciding to do this because I could never do that. But when I told it, I thought, well, you know, maybe they could do it, and maybe I need to help them do it their way instead of deciding what's my way. What I just alluded to brings us to the next step in this model. We need to, when we have an ethical dilemma, consult with colleagues and appropriate experts, other agency staff that may have more expertise. Supervisors are very, very important in a process of ethical decision making. Consultants are very important. Agency administrators, because sometimes the ethical decision that you make about a client may have a great impact on the agency, especially if it's a little bit contradictory to what the agency might believe. Attorneys, if people have an ethical decision, an ethical dilemma, very often there's a legal issue involved. And people's dilemma is, "I'm afraid to do it this way for fear I'm going to get in trouble with the law." I tell people, go to risk management at your agency. If you need to go to the agency administrator and get permission to go to the agency legal counsel, that is often very, very appropriate when you have an ethical decision. Very often, if the agency does not back your ethical decision, you are in trouble. Not only with the agency, but sometimes with a legal system. They also talk about ethics scholars. I've personally had great difficulty running down an ethics scholar on a moment's notice. I know several, and they're wonderful, but they're very busy people, and I can't just pick up the phone and get them to help me at that moment. But attending ethics workshops, listening to people, sometimes gives you ideas that have not crossed your mind in the process of doing your work. Sometimes what somebody else says makes something crystal clear because it's just never crossed your mind before. Finally, you have to make the ethical decision, and you should document the decision-making process. It would be nice if we could avoid making the decision, but we can't. And what we need to know in our decision-making process is that if I put 10 of you in a room and presented an ethical dilemma, I would probably have 11 different solutions to that dilemma because there are few absolutes. I can tell you as a former licensing board chair that absolutely, positively, under no circumstances can you have sex with your clients. That is the only thing that I can tell you absolutely, positively, you can't do. The other is open for determination, negotiation. So you have to make the ethical decision that fits for you given the circumstances of the case you're working with. Why do I say document the decision-making process? Many of us know if you don't document it, it never happened. But with emotionally charged things, and ethical decisions often are, you need to document so you can remember later not only what decision you made, but why you did it. What were the people involved? What were the alternatives? Why you made the decision that you made? After you've made the decision, after doing all of these steps, you need to monitor and evaluate the decision. Very often, we go through this whole decision-making process. A decision is made, and we get one little bitty piece of information that we didn't have before, and it changes everything. When I ask supervisees to present cases to me that are ethical in nature, we go through all of this. We talk about all of these steps. We go through all of these issues. And then they say, oops, I forgot to tell you something. And they throw out one tiny, what to them seems tiny at this point, or they've just forgotten it on purpose, throw out one tiny bit of information that totally changes everything. And then what do? You have to start the process all over again. Oh, I forgot to tell you that he has a long history of substance abuse, or that he was incarcerated and, you know, only got out of prison 3 days ago. That changes everything. So you have to start the process again. This is a process that keeps you focused. It is a process that keeps you on track. It gives you structure to make a good decision. I know that ethical dilemmas throw us for a loop. They throw me for a loop. I teach ethics all the time, but I still run up against things and think, what on earth am I supposed to do about this? I went in with a student once to see a patient. And there was so much going on with this patient that I felt like the tennis ball in a tennis match. I could not track. I had no idea what was going on, except I was very uncomfortable about some of the information that I had. We came out in the hall. The student said to me, "What's happening in there? What was going on?" I said to her, "I don't have the slightest idea. I need time to think about what was going on in there." She looked at me and said, "But you looked like you knew what was going on." And I said to her, "And that's what I hope I can teach you." I didn't want them to know that I was every bit as confused as they were. I wanted to make them feel comfortable. I wanted to get out. I wanted to have time to think through what was going on in order to help them make the best decision possible and for me to determine what I felt was the right way for them to go. This is what I hope the time that we have spent together has been able to do for you. It will give you a way to think through so that that initial confusion, that initial knot in your stomach, you know you have a way to deal with so that when you come out and think about it, you can make the best ethical decision based on the information that you have.